Welcome to the latest edition of the Insurer's Best Policy Podcast interview. Today, our guest is one of the London market's most prominent figures, Julian James. Julian's career included 20 years at the Corporation of Lloyd's, where he played a pivotal role in reassuring regulators and investors in the aftermath of 9/11, when the market's future looked so uncertain. Since then, he was CEO of Lotton International and then head of Allied World's international operations. He stepped down from Allied World in 2018 and enjoyed his first break from the industry in a 30-plus year career, a break which meant he was able to devote more time to one of his great passions, sailing. But earlier this year, he was tempted back, mooring his yacht at John Charman's Sompo International and becoming head of the Japanese insurer's London and international insurance operations. So I begin by asking Julian that when he left Allied World some 2 years ago, did he ever expect to return in an executive capacity?
Yeah, well, thanks, Peter. And firstly, many thanks for inviting me on to your podcast today. And many congratulations for getting this going. It's been a good source of information over the last few months. And, I really congratulate you for getting this running. For me, returning was always a possibility for the right challenge. I mean, I stopped full-time executive work about 18 months ago. You know, at that time, personally, it was a good opportunity to step back a little bit. Allied World had been sold to Fairfax. I sort of did the job that I was asked to do when I went in there. Clearly, it was a very difficult set of market conditions and trading conditions at those time. And personally, I just wanted the opportunity to take some time out and go and spend some time with family, do a bit of sailing, see more of my parents. So it was an easy decision to make at the time, but it was also a very easy decision to come back.
Thank you. And why was it an easy decision to come back? And I mean, what I mean by that is, what tempted you? What did John Charman say that made you return to the days of setting an alarm clock at the break of dawn?
What tempted me was 10 minutes on John Charman's sofa. He's a very persuasive individual, and maybe that doesn't sound right. But to be clear, there were other people in the room at the time, and he wasn't sitting on the same sofa as I was. But seriously, he sat down with John, and he's one of those great industry visionaries, and I've always admired what he has done personally throughout his career. And he explained his plans for Sompo. He set out the sort of vision that Sompo has for the development of the business, set out the ambition of the company. He set out some things that he was doing to try and realize that ambition. And it was just a very, compelling offer, to be frank. Also, I had the opportunity to meet some of the other executives at Sompo throughout this process. I liked them. I believed in the mission that John has sort of set himself and set ourselves. So it was actually a very, very easy decision to come back and set the alarm at 6 a.m. every morning.
Well, we'll go on and explore the kind of long-term vision for Sompo International a little later on. But perhaps one of the first actions that you did coming taking up the role was to sort of leave Sompo out of Lloyd's. And that, for anyone that's followed your career, that was seen quite a remarkable step. You've always been very passionate about Lloyd's. And indeed spent many years of your professional career there. So, I mean, how difficult a decision was it for you personally?
Well, the decision was always about us and not them. And it certainly was not a decision about me. It's about what's right for Sompo as we want to build out and develop the company. We've got a strong ambition to grow the business. We looked at Lloyd's and felt that simply wasn't possible on the Lloyd's platform. Needless to say, personally, and I think professionally, as far as Sompo is concerned, we're all incredibly supportive of Lloyd's and what John Neal is doing. I also think it's important to remind everybody about what we said, and that is that we said we were going to stop underwriting business through a Lloyd's syndicate at the end of this calendar year, but absolutely, we will continue to be a significant provider of reinsurance to Lloyd's businesses, and we provide capital to certain Lloyd's businesses. So it's not a hard and fast exit from Lloyd's, and we're never going to have any involvement again in the market. But as I'm sure you've heard over the years, Peter, I mean, the attraction that many people cite, and I absolutely believe this is true, for being in the Lloyd's market, predominantly revolve around three areas. One is access to their licenses, two is access to their rating, and three is use of the Lloyd's brand. And if I look at the licenses, for us, we have our own global licenses as Sompo. We have similar financial security ratings as Lloyd's does, and we want to develop and build our own brand. So, you know, we really felt it was in our best interest with our ambitions as a company to utilize one single platform in London, and we felt the company market was best for that.
Thank you. And presumably this was a decision that wasn't made lightly, Julian. I mean, was it a process, a sort of review process that already started before you joined, or was it something that you started the moment you had your feet under the desk?
The conversations have been bouncing around internally, as I'm sure you'd expect, for a decision of this magnitude for some time. John clearly explained that this was a conversation that was happening prior to me joining, and you know, the decision hadn't been made, and I said to him I felt I could contribute to some of the thinking about what was right for the company. You know, for me, worked in and around the Lloyd's market, as you said earlier, for large chunks of my career. I've also worked in the US, I've spent a great deal of time in Asia. So my view of insurance is not always just, you know, focused on EC3. For us, when we look forward, the key thing for us is to build out our international presence outside of Japan. And, you know, if I look at growth, it was kind of one of the areas that we felt Lloyd's couldn't offer us. And if you then think a little bit further and you think about, you know, what is the right and the most efficient way to build an underwriting business, it's very easy to make a case that it's better to do that through one platform. You don't have the distraction of running, you know, multiple boards, multiple sets of reporting. But probably most importantly, it's clearer to all of our customers, and whether it be brokers or clients, that we're operating through one mechanism. So, you know, make these decisions lightly or quickly, but that's a little bit of an insight into some of our thinking. But let's be clear, you know, Lloyd's and London is a great platform, and the work that John is doing, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later on, you know, is absolutely the right level of work to protect the interests of the market going forward.
No, thank you, Julian. Well, actually, I'd like to pick up on that point now, because the other John that you refer to, John Neal, Lloyd's CEO, when he returned to Lime Street in 2018, he made it clear that the market's underwriting results have to improve, but also that its cost base has to be challenged. And I mean, you don't address that point, but I mean, was that an issue as well for Sompo's decision? In other words, the cost of running a business at Lloyd's?
It's certainly a consideration, but it wasn't the primary driver. You know, John is, you know, clearly trying to transform the market. It's a natural home, in my view, for specialty risks. People have been predicting the demise of Lloyd's certainly ever since I've been around the market, you know, in the best part of the last 40 years. But the reality is, you know, Lloyd's has been home to specialty business for the last 350 years. And, you know, if you look at the last London Matters report, you know, it's shown that its market share globally has grown every year since 2015. So, you know, the transformation of the Lloyd's market is not, you know, a radical transformation. It's a sort of evolution from the position that's been in over the years.
And you're optimistic that, I mean, that certainly the John Neal set out this very bold vision, and I think, you know, most people were very supportive of it. Are you optimistic that those changes and reforms are still going to take place, and that, you know, Lloyd's will come out of it a leaner, better defined market as a consequence?
Yeah, no, I'm very optimistic. I'm an optimistic person by nature, but, you know, as I said earlier, all the activity and the agenda that has been set for Lloyd's is absolutely the right one. John is absolutely right. You know, you can't continue operating in a market with the level of frictional cost that exists. I mean, customers shouldn't be paying that level of wastage on their risk premium to pay for the cost of doing business through the London market and through Lloyd's. He's absolutely front and centre of changing the culture of the market. And that, again, you know, is absolutely the right course of action. And if you step back and think, I mean, Lloyd's is, and actually everybody is very good at criticising the Lloyd's market and saying the world's about to end and all that stuff. But, you know, in the last 20 years that I've been sort of working for the corporation and working in underwriting businesses around the edge of it, you know, you need to look at the facts, and the facts are very simple. I mean, in 2018, Lloyd's London wrote, you know, $110 billion of premium, and that's more than its three closest competitors combined. And Lloyd's is right in the centre of all of that. So yes, things need to change. Yes, areas need to improve. But, you know, actually, you've got to look at the position that the London market has and where it is compared to where it was even 10 years ago.
No, good point, Julian. And actually, another positive some people would suggest is that Lloyd's and indeed the wider London market has adapted quite well to the rigours of lockdown restrictions, certainly in terms of the kind of processes, something that London has not always been exemplary at. But of course, we now know that John Neil has set a timetable for sort of gradually reopening the Lloyd's underwriting floor that starts in September. Do you feel that you're concerned that there might be a danger that some of this momentum that we've accelerated momentum we've gained on e-placements around PPL, that might be lost simply because people may go back to the old ways of doing business?
Absolutely, the momentum will not be lost. I mean, the secret sauce, as we know, the London market is the interaction between people, you know, who work in it, and working 100% remotely, you know, would lose that vital ingredient. You know, and the second secret sauce that exists in the London market, you know, is the concentration of talent. And therefore, you know, it's really important to find mechanisms to make sure that concentration of talent stays together and there is the ability for the interaction between the people who work in the market. If you look at what underpins all of that, again, look at what's happened and look at the facts. But the fact is that the London market has built an e-placement platform that meant it could actually continue to trade remotely. And it's actually great evidence that we're not as technically challenged as we all think we are and as is written in the press. And, you know, if you look at trading in Lloyd's, I was looking the other day, there's a 17-page protocol to follow if you want to transact business by email. So if you look at PPL, what PPL has done, and, you know, nothing's perfect when you launch it, but it does work. You know, it provides the legal clarity and the usage clearly has shot through the roof. But as I say, that's great. But actually what you need to do is to find the mechanism for the people to be able to interact. But I don't talk to anybody who has any doubt that the actions of the last sort of 3 or 4 months, you know, has clearly demonstrated that PPL is a very good system and no one's going to go back to how we were trading before. It's just madness.
Does it sort of bring into question the certainly in the medium to long term, the future of a physical trading floor at Lloyd's? I mean, clearly Lloyd's has been based around face-to-face trading, as you say, for 350 years. But I mean, is that a question that the Lloyd's market's going to have to ask itself?
Well, they have been asking themselves that question virtually every year since I've been around there. And, you know, again, look at the facts. You know, the number of people going and transacting business on a day-to-day basis in the Lloyd's market, you know, is in gradual decline, and that's only natural. I mean, a lot of business is, you know, is done in the offices around the market, less so in the wine bars these days, more in the coffee shops. But the fact that Lloyd's and Lime Street and the concentration of companies exists there is a really important ingredient. And having a trading floor and a building the size of Lloyd's, you know, acts as a facilitator to that interaction. So I don't see it ever disappearing.
Actually, and that's one final question on Lloyd's, Julian. Next year, of course, will be the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, which for those of us in the industry at the time was a sort of defining moment. And of course, you were at Lloyd's and you were at the vanguard of Lloyd's having to lobby with regulators, both in London and, of course, overseas, and US in particular. And it'd be very interesting with that anniversary in mind, just to get your thoughts on, you know, just how bleak was the situation then? Because, you know, there were, I think, concerns that Lloyd's at the very least had a liquidity crisis, but potentially even, solvency issues as well. I mean, now it's ancient history. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on how close to the abyss that we went.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are many reasons and many people who insured and worked to keep the market trading. I remember, and it was a terrible moment in our history, both as a human race and as an industry. You know, the number of people that were, you know, we all knew and friends who had died in that. It was a massive shock. But I do remember sort of 2 days after 9/11, I was talking to, I think it was Stephen Catlin. And, you know, I said, Stephen, you know, what's happening in your business, how's it going? And he said to me, well, actually, you know, my instruction to our underwriters is to continue trading and make markets in the business lines that we're comfortable doing that. And I remember thinking after that, well, you know, despite all the negativity and chaos, you know, and all the commentary around Lloyd's, London, future of the, you know, actually the entire financial services world, it was really, really important for all of us to ensure that Lloyd's survived, because they are, you know, Lloyd's continues to be, you know, one of the entities that allows airlines to fly and ships to travel around the world and all those sort of good things in commerce. And therefore, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind, sort of sitting in the centre of the market, that, you know, it was important and actually vital to the, you know, economies of the world that Lloyd's continued to trade. And yeah, there were some issues that we need to work through. There were some solvency things and no one knew what the size of the loss was. And there were, you know, some rather strange things in terms of structure of some of the trust funds and expectations of regulators around the world that we needed to work through. But we did. And with the help of many great people, you know, the market emerged stronger from that. And, you know, what people also forget and that gets lost in the mists of time, it was the catalyst for implementing the franchise structure in the Lloyd's system. You know, that didn't exist at the time. And bizarrely, I mean, everyone remembers where they were when 9/11 happened. I was sitting in a boardroom for Bain & Company, who were helping a group from the market think through the Chairman's Strategy Group, as it was known at the time. And we were discussing, you know, could we actually implement this franchise structure and how would it all work? And, you know, would the market accept this level of intrusion? And, you know, how would you kind of have control over underwriting? But actually what happened after 9/11, after once you got through some of the short-term issues, was it provided the impetus to change the market fundamentally. Because everyone said, you can't operate as we have been operating historically. So, you know, there's any good that came out of 9/11, you know, it was a new structure for the market, which has stood the test of time over the last 19 years and actually made Lloyd's even stronger than it was, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. Let's turn to Sompo. At the beginning of the interview, you asked you what was the decision to come back, and you said it was 10 minutes with John Charman. And so how did he, in those 10 minutes, unveil the Sompo International vision? You know, what is the strategy? What do you want to build the business into?
I mean, just to be clear, in those 10 minutes, I didn't let John know that he'd got me over the line. But I knew from my early interaction with him as a broker in the 1980s, you never wanted to declare your hand too quickly with John. So we actually had some slightly longer conversations, just 10 minutes. But the vision that he outlined to me was that Sompo wants to become a top 10 global insurance group. And they want to do that by diversifying risk, and felt that most of the expansion is going to happen outside of Japan. And therefore, what that means for us is that we need to pull the businesses together that exist already outside of Japan. We've got a very strong ambition for growth. And over time, you know, you'll see the profit contribution that exists in Sompo Holdings coming more from outside of Japan than it does today. And all of that is on top of what has been quite a lot of growth over the last few years. And I was looking at some numbers the other day, but the growth since 2014 at Sompo has been over 136%. And all of that, in my mind, is a great place to start from. There's a very strong risk-taking culture, underwriting culture, as you'd expect in a business run by John. And we can leverage that to make sure that we can deliver on the ambitions that the group has in terms of their position on the sort of global scale.
Thank you. And actually, on that point, Julian, I mean, at your previous role at Allied World, you were instrumental in their strategy of kind of creating or acquiring significant international platforms, often in emerging, you know, stroke fast developing economies. Will you be adopting that same approach at Sompo? And if so, which geographies and indeed classes are you especially keen on?
I'd say very clearly that nothing's off the table. Quite how things evolve is sometimes a matter for, you know, what's happening externally, and, you know, opportunities and businesses get sold and bought for different reasons. But absolutely, you know, as a said before, we have strong ambitions for growth. Some of that's going to be organic, some of it might be acquisition based, some of it might be, you know, using some of the products that we have in other jurisdictions and making them available, you know, to other parts of Sompo International. So the growth is going to come from a mixture of sources, but all of that is going to be, you know, underpinned by a relentless focus on trying to build out a customer-centric business. And, you know, I've been a strong advocate throughout the years to know that, you know, businesses survive by being customer-centric, and therefore whatever we do needs to be relevant to our customers, whether they be brokers or risk managers.
Gotcha. But on that point, I mean, John Charman is famous for being opportunistic and nimble-footed and, you know, seizing opportunities when they present themselves. This has been a feature of his career throughout his entire career. And on that note, have you or John sort of spied new opportunities that have emerged because of the COVID-19 crisis that we've endured this year? And if so, you know, what are they? Has it in any way changed your strategy or indeed your outlook?
Yeah, no, of course the recent events have changed our, you know, some of our sort of tactical decisions and opportunities. I mean, John is one of those great industry visionaries. I know you've had a number of people on your podcast, you know, listen to Stephen the other day and, you know, listen to Brian O'Hara. And, you know, John is one of those people who sees things that other people don't. And that's why, you know, he has been so successful. Yes, there are other ingredients like being nimble-footed and seizing opportunities. And John has a view of the world which is, in my mind, visionary about the opportunity. The message that he instills and has instilled throughout his life, I think, is that, you know, first and foremost, we are an underwriting business. And therefore, you need to be risk takers. You know, you need to focus on making smart underwriting decisions. And you also need to focus on delivering products that customers want. So no one ever knew that COVID-19 was going to happen on this scale, and no one knows when it's going to end. But clearly we are making different underwriting decisions today than we were 4 months ago.
And of course, one of the consequences of the pandemic seems to be an acceleration in the kind of market hardening in many specialty and reinsurance classes. Something, of course, that was beginning beforehand, but I think the kind of received wisdom is that that's accelerated. And indeed, a number of industry leaders have now commentated that this is a hard market. Would you characterise it as such?
To be honest, I have no idea whether it's a hard market or not, and I think it's a completely irrelevant point. My criticism of our world is that we as the insurance market need to stop being so inwardly looking and obsessed about pricing levels and cycles. And actually, we would all do a better job if we spent more time worrying about our clients. You know, clients want partners who will accept their risks at a fair price. And their concerns are always around, you know, products and whether we're going to be there to pay the claims on a timely basis and efficiently. And we spend, you know, if I look at the rhetoric that has gone on for the last 4 months about, you know, pricing levels and hard markets, soft market, all that stuff, we just need to kind of grow up a little bit and actually think about our customers and just sort of stop obsessing about pricing. I mean, clearly pricing levels are greater today than they were 3 years ago in most lines of business, and deservedly so, because people weren't making money 3 years ago, and, you know, we need to make money to survive. But is it hard? Is it soft? I don't know. And I don't, to be honest, spend too much time worrying about it. What I worry about is whether we're delivering products for our customer at a fair price to us for taking on their risk.
Well, yeah, and let's focus on the customer, because we've also seen a number of ugly disputes emerge from the COVID-19 crisis, primarily around BI cover. It's led to litigation. It's led to threats from US lawmakers to sort of, you know, effectively impose retrospective liabilities on the industry. Bearing that in mind, I mean, and the fact that the customer must come central, I mean, in your view, do you think the industry has had a good crisis thus far? Could it have done anything better?
You can always do a lot better. And, you know, I was listening to David Howden speak, and, you know, I think he articulated that point very well. But whatever the arguments are around specific classes of business, the answer in my mind is not to retrospectively change a contract or the law. And, you know, we've seen the attempts from, you know, various lawmakers, and generally it's the sort of elected lawmakers who make it a very popular theme to say, well, actually, you excluded something and therefore it's unfair on the customer, and now actually we're going to make sure that, you know, you give the coverage which you didn't intend to give. And that is stupid in my mind. I mean, it underpins or undermines everything that exists, the entire basis of global trade. So, you know, those attempts, I think, and I think Dan Glaser made a similar point, are just stupid in my mind. You know, disputes are never good for anybody. You know, I think that we have sort of clear wordings, and, you know, there will sometimes be different interpretations, and that's just normal course of business.
But are there any sort of obvious lessons that, you know, we can draw upon from one, the crisis, and two, the industry's response?
Yeah, I think we need to do a better job at, you know, explaining some of the facts. I mean, ultimately, in times of disaster, the insurance market is there to pay claims. I don't read anything about the fact that we are paying out claims on a daily basis to support businesses. I mean, whatever figure you want to put on the aggregate loss position for the Lloyd's market, you know, whether it's 3 billion, 4 billion, it depends who you read. The fact of life is they've paid probably, I think I was looking at some stuff the other day, the beginning of this month, they've paid almost 1 billion of those claims. Now, do we ever talk about that? And do we ever sort of explain to people that that's what is going on? No, we don't. We sort of obsess about the disputes and, you know, and some of the areas where, you know, there's lack of clarity. But overall, if I look at the response of the entire market, and this is brokers and underwriters alike, I think it's been pretty good. Businesses haven't fallen over. We're continuing to price risk. We're continuing to make markets. We're continuing, by and large, to sit down with our clients and help them through this. And that, I'm not sure, would have happened 20 years ago for a crisis of this magnitude. So overall, you know, if we can stop obsessing about ourselves and focus on our customers, I think we've had a pretty good response so far to what's been going on.
Great. Thank you, Julian. I mean, actually, another outcome from the economic crisis is a reminder that the industry collectively does not have the balance sheet to sustain kind of systemic losses, economic losses that crises like COVID-19 can bring to bear. And this, of course, has led to an acceleration of debate about public-private partnerships. And we know in the UK, as in indeed many other countries, that there are moves afoot to develop public-private pandemic reinsurance solutions, which presumably, one, you think is a good thing. But two, there's also some people are saying that actually, let's not just stop at pandemic solutions, because there are other existential threats, terrorism, cyber, climate change. I mean, do you have a view as to whether this perhaps is an opportunity for the industry to negotiate with governments and sort of create systemic or existential kind of reinsurance platforms for other risks? Because of course, the next catastrophe, mega catastrophe, may not be a pandemic. It may be something entirely different.
Yeah, no, of course it's an opportunity, and it's a great reminder that the capital of the insurance industry, you know, is limited, and there are certain risks that exist around the world that, you know, the insurance industry can't take on. And the only way that can really be solved is through some form of partnership with government. And as you say, there are many examples of this, whether it's, you know, Californian earthquake risk, or whether it's flood risk in the UK, or terrorism risk, or anything like that. The criticism I think we should have of ourselves in our own self-graded scorecard is that most of the time we react after the event. And I was reminded quite early on in this crisis of a conversation that I had back in, it was 2004. And I was lucky enough to go to the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos. And it was round about the time of the SARS crisis. And one of the meetings I went to in the spirit of Davos was with a group from the travel and the airline industry. You know, it was typically the leaders of those businesses. And they turned around and said, look, you know, we've just gone through SARS, and, you know, it was mainly an Asian type of situation. you need to provide insurance coverage for pandemic risks like SARS. And I said to them, we can't do it, right? You know, we'd love to give you the cover, we'd love to take your premium, but there's a finite amount of capital. And I said at the time, I said, I would urge you all to be thinking as an industry group, how you lobby governments to encourage some form of partnership. Well, you know, clearly nothing happened. And, you know, most of the insurance industry excluded pandemic risk for the reasons I outlined. And we should have done something about it then. And that's what happens with most of these situations, whether it's terrorism or earthquake. You know, these mechanisms are put in place. So, yes, let's take this as an opportunity to identify some other areas of concern and start beginning that dialogue, you know, before the event actually happens.
Yeah, good point, Julian. Drawing towards the end of our interview, but I've probably got time for just two more questions. And there's one issue which we've yet to explore, and that is a consolidation among the international brokers. And next year, Aon, of course, is due to complete its acquisition of Willis. And that will accelerate the concentration of distributors that bring business to Sompo. Is it a good thing to have such a concentration of distribution for you and indeed for other underwriting businesses?
I mean, the broking industry is fiercely competitive. And yes, you know, if you look at the structure of it, there will be two very large houses. But, you know, if you talk to any broker, whether it's an Aon broker or one from a smaller company, they will always find ways of competing with each other. And that's very healthy. And I don't see that changing just because Aon acquires Willis.
Well, that's a positive note. But let's finish on a final question, which is the next generation. And if a young, ambitious individual, maybe a graduate, asks you for advice on joining the industry, one, would you recommend they do so? And if so, and would you recommend they went down the underwriting route or indeed the broking route?
Well, seeing the world from both sides of the street always offers the best perspective long term. I was just sniggering because it's a very topical conversation in the James household. As my eldest son thinks about his career move, he's very keen to join in the insurance world. You know, he's done internships on both the broking and the underwriting side, and you know, he's asked me that. We've had many conversations about where is the right place to start, and he doesn't always listen to me, my son. But the advice I've given him is that you know, it doesn't really matter where he starts on the playing field. The important thing is to get on the playing field. And it's also really important over time to make sure that you work on both sides of the street.
Yeah.
Because you will be a better person. And I was very early on in my life, you know, I started at Sedgwick, which is clearly now part of Marsh. You should do many different things throughout your insurance career. I've ended up being very fortunate. I've worked with some great people. I've worked in underwriting businesses. I've worked in, you know, a business managing a market. I've worked in the States. I've worked in London. I've spent a lot of time in Asia. And actually, I think that experience, if you can build it into, you know, your career, will stand you in better stead because you can see, as I say, the world from both sides of the street. I think in the short term, and I'll sort of close, but there is an issue that is facing our industry that's beginning to emerge. And that is that, you know, most people, as my son has found out, have stopped hiring people. And that's fine for a month and it's fine for a couple of months. It's not good for us long term. And as we figure out, and as we sort of think through COVID and its implications and how we're all now going to work, we all need to return to a normal way of operating. And part of that normal way of operating is to bring talent into our industry. Yep. And I think as we kind of move forward and think about that, I would urge all businesses to think through, you know, how that pipeline continues and how we can actually sort of restart that hiring process.
Yes, I mean, actually, that's a very good point, Julian. And indeed, that presumably will be exacerbated the longer we work remotely. Is that correct? I mean, or do you feel that the situation can be remedied as long as new processes are put in place?
I think we just need to start paying attention to it. It can be remedied. And if you pay attention to it, it will follow. But, you know, everyone's reaction has been to sort of, well, pull the shutters up and pull the drawbridge up and, you know, don't hire new people because you've got to, you know, protect your existing staff. And that's absolutely rational at the time. But as we're emerging through this, and I don't know whether we're on day 100, whatever it is, since lockdown began in the UK, you need to start thinking about your business for the future. And part of any business is to get a good array of talent coming into it. And I'm not saying this just because my son's trying to find a job and, you know, he needs to stop mowing my lawn every day. You know, that's what we need to do to protect our industry and protect its long-term future.
And that brings to an end our Best Policy interview with Julian James. Thank you to all our listeners and also to Julian for being our guest this week.